underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Tara Westover was 17 the first time she set foot in a classroom. Born to survivalists in the mountains of Idaho, she prepared for the end of the world by stockpiling home canned peaches and sleeping with her head for the hills bag. When her brother got himself into college and came back with news of the world beyond the mountain, Tara decided to try a new kind of life. She taught herself enough mathematics, grammar, and science to take the ACT and was admitted to Brigham Young University. After graduating from Brigham Young with honors, she went on to earn a PhD in history from Cambridge University. Westover writes about her awkward transition into the mainstream and her painful struggles with her family in Educated, a Memoir. It is a great pleasure to welcome Tara Westover to this week's book show. Tara, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
At what point in your life did you realize that your story was unusual, that you were not growing up in a manner normal for a girl your age?
You know, I suppose I knew that we weren't living the way other children lived, because I could see that the other kids in my town went to school, and I was obviously aware that I didn't go to school. But, I mean, I didn't see us as unusual so much as I thought that we were living the right way. And, you know, it was the only life that I had ever known. So to me, in a lot of ways, it seemed really normal. It wasn't until I got to be much older that I realized kind of how unusual it was that my dad had these beliefs where he was opposed to public education, he was opposed to doctors and hospitals. So that meant that, you know, we never went to the doctor, not when we were ill, not even when we were injured. And we were injured kind of a lot because my dad owned a junkyard. You know, there was a time my brother accidentally lit his leg on fire in my dad's junkyard and was covered in third-degree burns, and we treated that at home with my mother's herbalism, which seemed completely normal to me at the time, but as I got older, seemed more strange.
Your father distrusted nearly all institutions, of course, including the public school system. What brought that distrust to him?
I'm not sure. You know, after I went to school and I learned about disorders like bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, you know, I'm not a medical professional, so I don't know where my dad's kind of paranoias and extreme views came from. But when I learned about those disorders, I did feel like I was being given a way to understand my upbringing and some of the choices that he had made that I just hadn't had when I was growing up. You know, to me, everything that he said sounded completely like the truth because his was the only perspective that I had any access to. I didn't go to school. So his version of history, his version of everything, you know, the way that he said the world was, seemed to me like that was the way that it was.
So often your background is described as an upbringing in a survivalist family. How do you look at it? Is that a proper way of describing the background?
I think it's a beginning. This book, to me, it's about families and it's about change and it's about all the many versions of a person that can exist in the space of a life. And it's about whether the first form that we take is our only true form or whether we're allowed to change.
As you write about in the book, you were 17 years old when you first set foot in a classroom. How did you get to that point?
I had an older brother who had gone to a few years of school before my father had developed his radical ideas and before he'd pulled everyone out. And he had even been allowed, I think, to go to the eighth grade. And he was just incredibly self-motivated. So he had bought his own trigonometry book, taught himself trigonometry, taught himself algebra, taught himself calculus, and then he went to college and he came back. He was quite a few years older than I was when I was 16 and just said to me, look, you can do this. Just buy a study guide, learn enough to scrape through this one test, and you can go to college. And at the time I was working for my dad in the junkyard. It was a pretty dangerous job. People got hurt a lot. It wasn't a very nice way to live. So I didn't really know what college was. I had no idea. I'd never been in a classroom before, but I thought I would try it.
What was your father's reaction to you going to school for the first time?
You know, I'd been hard on him, I think, when my brother went, because he was very skeptical of universities. He thought that they were brainwashing institutions. I think he was particularly hard on him when I went. I think because I was a girl, my dad had pretty strong ideas about the age that I would get married, the age that I would have children. He wanted me to be a midwife like my mother. So I think for him, it was certainly a source of conflict between the two of us.
You write about being in those first lectures and just having a baseline much, much lower than most, if not all, of the other students, of not knowing what the Holocaust was, of not having an understanding of the civil rights movement. How did you overcome that initially? I mean, because you have to rebound from that fairly quickly.
I think there was just the shock of kind of realizing the depth of my own ignorance. I guess I'd imagined that I'd received an education at home, and it really wasn't until I began learning about the Holocaust, about the civil rights movement, things. It's not that I didn't know details about them. I didn't know anything about them at all. I didn't know that they had happened. And I just started where you start. I started taking classes. I had to do a lot of extra reading to get contextual knowledge that a lot of people had already. I had friends who helped me. I had professors that helped me. I mean, there's probably a sense in which I never am going to catch up. There's going to be some holes in my knowledge, maybe. But I think in a lot of ways, the university was a really wonderful place to arrive and have a lot of questions. It was a difficult transition. Just that whole experience and time in my life of getting access to different points of view and different ideas of history, it was a really difficult time, but it was also a really exciting time.
Tara Westover is our guest. The name of the memoir is Educated. It is published by Random House. You do describe this sudden surge of knowledge as both wonderful and terrifying. What was terrifying about it?
I think just coming to terms with the depth of everything I didn't know. In a way, the more that I learned, the more that this world that I had grown up believing in was just slowly being torn away. You know, I'd grown up without access to a lot of other perspectives of history or of anything else. And there was something kind of comforting maybe in having that one interpretation of everything, that one way of understanding everything. And even though it was really exciting to learn about different things, I mean, the civil rights movement, these really mind-blowing things for me. But there was also something just alarming about losing the certainty that I had had in my life when I had believed in the world my father had made for me.
When you started this process of learning, and especially in the subject of history, as you write, that became a passion. That became something that you became almost obsessed with, of learning that history.
History was the first time that I felt like I began to have a real independence of mind. So after I learned about the Holocaust, I took an entire course in Jewish history. I think it was maybe my last year at BYU, my dad visited me and we went to dinner, and he started one of his lectures. He was really quite famous for just giving these long lectures. And in this lecture, he started saying a lot of things I'd heard him say before, but I was hearing them very differently now. He was talking about he said that the Jews were trying to start a world war so they could consolidate their power, and he had all of these conspiracy theories he was talking about. And listening to him, I realized, unwittingly, I was sure, but he was quoting from the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and I knew the history of that text because I'd studied it. I knew that it had emerged at the turn of the century, and I knew that it had been discredited as a forgery in the 1920s, but that hadn't stopped Adolf Hitler from quoting it in Mein Kampf. I knew that my father would have been horrified to be quoting Adolf Hitler. And it was the first time I think there was a real reversal in our relationship, in the parent-child relationship, because parents often have that experience of having a child say something and the child doesn't really know what they're saying, but the parent does. But this was the first time that I felt like I didn't know where my dad had gotten that idea. I thought maybe he'd read, you know, maybe something from the John Birch Society. He had a lot of those pamphlets around. I didn't know where he got it from, but I knew that he didn't know the history of it, and I did know the history of it, and I felt like I knew what he was saying, and he didn't.
Did that give you a power? Did that feel powerful at the moment?
It did, I think, because it was the first time I felt like he was saying that the world was one way, And I understood what he was saying. It's not that I didn't understand it. I just didn't agree with it. And it was an independence of mind that I hadn't had before. And I think that this ability to have a disagreement with my parents, especially my dad, over the past, what had happened in the past, I think it would transfer over into other parts of my life where I would also begin to have my own ideas about what was happening in the present. And that would become important because, you know, my family was a family that was infected with violence. I had an older brother who for many years had been violent towards me, towards other people. And in my family, like in many families, that had been normalized. It had been downplayed, euphemized, justified. And I think beginning to develop that ability to say, well, you think one thing and I think something else, it would have pretty profound implications for those relationships.
You write about that moment where you went to your parents for their help in trying to put an end to the abuse. What did you believe that they could do, and what ultimately were they able to do?
You know, my brother, he could be this amazing person. He could be kind. He could be sensitive. He'd saved my life before, put his real life his own life in danger when we were breaking horses together and working in the scrapyard. But he had this other side to him where he could be incredibly cruel, and he could be controlling and ask you to do things, and if you wouldn't do them, he would get violent. He had a name for me when I was 16. His favorite name for me was whore, which really just entered into my mind and entered into how I thought about myself. So much so that I wrote a journal entry when I was 16 about my brother that included the sentence, "It's strange how you give the people you love so much power over you." But my brother had an incredible amount of power over me, more than I would have even understood at the time, because he defined me to myself. And I don't think that there's a greater power than that. Something would happen with me and my brother, some kind of violent altercation. He often would twist my wrist behind my back until it sprained. Within a few minutes of that, he could convince me that it hadn't happened, that it had been a game, and that if I'd only spoken up a little bit, he would have stopped. You know, it was a real invasion of the mind. I have a theory that all abuse, no matter what kind of abuse it is an assault on the mind. For me, as I got stronger mentally, I think that became harder for him to do. Increasingly, I was able to hold on to my own interpretation of what was happening, even when he would try to come in and tell me it was something else. So the night that I decided to talk to my parents about it, I suppose I thought it needed to be stopped. I didn't think that it was something that we couldn't get over. You know, I had decided that it wasn't acceptable, and I had decided that it needed to end. But I don't think I imagined that it would have the incredible destructive power that it ended up having.
Your parents chose not to acknowledge the abuse, but did they know about it? Were they aware of it?
I think they'd seen enough to be very familiar with it. And I think they'd seen it with other people, not just with me. But in a way, I think, you know, the night I confronted my father especially and said, I need this to stop. I need you to put a stop to this. In a way, I think if he'd just not acknowledged it, it would have been very painful. But I wonder if we would have found a way to negotiate that the way that we were negotiating the fact that I was at Cambridge and my dad was against that, or that he had had this terrible injury in a scrapyard where a car had exploded and they hadn't gone to the hospital, and I didn't like that. But, you know, we were all negotiating each other despite all of these differences. But they didn't not acknowledge what I'd said. What they did do was they called my brother and they told him what I'd said. What followed after that was a period of some months where my brother would call and threaten me, would tell me that he had hired an assassin to come kill me. And he actually would, in the end, disown me, and my parents would support that decision.
Talk a little bit, just before we delve into the educational aspect here, of your background was a Mormon background. How much did that fuel the ideology that brought your family to Idaho and brought your parents and their children off the grid and away from a quote-unquote normal way of life?
I've always thought very little. My father was raised mainstream Mormon in a town that was mainstream Mormon. No one else in our town, or maybe one other family, you know, didn't send their kids to school. But I don't know anyone else in the town that didn't go to the doctor, that didn't register their children for birth certificates. I think, again, I've speculated that my father has something like bipolar disorder, and I've long felt that the bipolar disorder produced the religious extremism and not the other way around, because my dad was extreme about everything. He was extreme about the government. He was extreme about doctors. He was extreme about... But Mormonism, you know, it is kind of important to me that people realize my father is not an example of mainstream Mormonism. He's very much his own kind of brand.
You went first to Brigham Young University. I'm curious as to when you personally felt that you were excelling, that you were doing well.
Well, I failed several of my first exams, so not then.
But you graduated magna cum laude, so things got better.
I did recover. I recovered well enough in my first semester that, it, you know, it wasn't terrible. I think probably somewhere in my third or fourth semesters, I really started to feel like I understood the homework assignments. I understood what I was supposed to do. I understood how to do it. And when I did it, I did well. But there was a long period before that where I just, you know, the just continuous, just endless stretch of errors that I would make, that I took an art class and we were given a glossy book with illustrations in it to look at, full of pictures of art, and I just didn't realize that it was actually a textbook, that we were supposed to read it. Mm. I thought it was an art class and we were just supposed to look at the art. And it sounds so ridiculous to try to explain, but I just had no idea that we were supposed to read it. And so the syllabus would say pages 20 to 30, and I would just look at the pictures on that page. And what I didn't know is the exams were based entirely on the textbook. So, you know, I mean, once I started understanding what a syllabus was, that I had to read it, what a textbook was, all this kind of just really basic knowledge, I just didn't have it.
You graduated from Brigham Young. You went to Cambridge. You completed a PhD. You were a visiting fellow at Harvard before that. During all of these years of education, what was your relationship like with your family? And because you're in two very different worlds, aren't you?
You know, it was hard on everyone, I think, because they were becoming more radical, and I was moving towards the mainstream. And that was, you know, it was difficult for my father when I'd made the decision to go to Cambridge, and it was difficult for me to watch them living the way that they did. These horrible accidents would happen in the junkyard. You know, I said my dad was standing next to a car when it exploded because he hadn't drained the fuel tank before he tried to remove it. And he was burned horribly. And my family made the decision to treat that burn at home with Comfrey and Lobelia. And he nearly died. And it was very hard for me to watch them living that way. And it was hard for them to watch me making choices that they didn't agree with. But it was something that we were negotiating. And I was able to go to Cambridge and then go to Idaho at Christmas. And I was able to be both of those people. And really, I think what we couldn't negotiate, it would be my brother Sean, and it would be my choosing to confront my parents and ask for their help, and it would be their decision to, I don't know, I guess say that I was lying and then tell my brother what I'd said, and in a lot of ways just really try to discredit me in order to avoid dealing with the issue.
In that dealing with the issue, did you come to the point where you have to make really solid decisions of what the relationship is going to be like with your family, correct?
Well, so I was disowned for about a year because of my brother's decision. And after that year, I was offered a way back into the family. My father had been telling people that I was possessed by a demon, and that's why I had said the things I'd said about my brother. And he actually came, he never travels, but he came to visit me when I was a visiting fellow at Harvard. And so he turned up at Harvard, and what he offered me as a way back into the family was a kind of exorcism where I would submit to this blessing, and then I would essentially recant everything that I'd said, basically say the devil made me say it. You know, there was a period of several days where I was just sightseeing around Boston with my parents. I was kind of arguing with myself, thinking maybe this was a deal I could make, and I was trying to justify it in my own mind, try to argue with myself and convince myself that there would be some dignity in what I planned to do, to deny my own memories, my own sense of what had happened and what hadn't happened, and of sanity and all the rest of it, in order to earn the love of my parents. And ultimately, on the night that he offered me the blessing, I couldn't do it, and I declined. And I suppose that was the first time that my estrangement from my family was in any meaningful way my choice, because up till that point, it had been wholly involuntary. I would have done anything I thought to get them back until a way was offered, and then I realized I wouldn't quite do anything, because what my dad was offering me was a way where I could go back into the family, but only by going back to the person that I'd been when I'd been a child, when I had been someone who didn't have her own ideas about the past, about the present, who wasn't the sort of person who would say, this is happening and it can't happen anymore and I won't stop talking about it until we stop it from happening. That was the only way I could go back in the family, is if I could kind of become that other person. And the person that, you know, the daughter that my father had come to reclaim, she didn't exist anymore. She'd gone off and she'd read and she'd thought about things and she'd developed her own opinions and her own ideas about things. And she had no tolerance for violence and she could not give way to it.
Do you ever see that changing? Do you ever see yourself changing in that view?
And where I could go back to who I was.
Not to go back who you were, but to work more on a family relationship.
I suppose in some ways I always will be looking for signs that my family culture has changed. So I guess I would say I watch for those signs, but I don't wait for them. It took me a lot of years to really accept the estrangement. You know, the time that I turned away from the blessing was sort of one step. And then there were many years that followed of me trying to make the family relationships work, trying to find a way to make it safe for me to go there, even though my brother was threatening violence and my parents were looking the other way. But ultimately, I think eventually I realized there are limits to the obligations that you owe to your family. And sometimes when what you owe to your family, it can come in conflict with what you owe to yourself. And there are times where it's okay to choose yourself. And it's okay to have enough self-love to pursue your own happiness and insist on your own safety. Those are two things that you're allowed to do. And I feel like with the way my family is now, I can't do those things. I especially can't insist on my own safety. So I guess there's a sense in which I feel that whether or not I reconcile with my parents feels completely outside of my power, because in order for me to reconcile with them, they would have to change. They don't have to change for me to forgive them or for me to love them, but they do have to change for me to have them in my life.
And do you live with just an assumption that, for example, they don't know that your book is at the top of the New York Times bestseller list?
I don't know what they know about the book.
Yeah. And I assume, and not, I don't mean this as nasty as it may sound, but you probably don't care either, right?
I do care. I thought about them a lot when I was writing the book, and I tried to give as empathetic an account of why they did what they did as I possibly could. I don't think that my parents, when they chose not to believe me that night about my brother, I don't think they foresaw what would happen. I think that they thought I could be put back into the box. I think that they thought it would be a lot easier to silence me than it turned out to be. I don't think either one of them imagined they would end up telling everyone I was possessed or trying to discredit me or running this whole campaign. I don't think they realized that was the path that they were committing themselves to. And I think they imagined that I would back down and that the status quo could just resume. So in a way, I do feel like they did not intend for this. But as I said, I wasn't someone who could live with the situation the way that it had been. I'd changed too much. I just wasn't someone who could submit to that.
Tara Westover's memoir is entitled Educated. It is published by Random House. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.